Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here live on the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the weekdays. KPFK on Sunday mornings, except during Fun Drive, like right now. Coming up, Marjorie Cohn on the drone papers. But first, Patrick Eddington from the Cato Institute. He's the author of this very interesting piece that ran in the New York Times, believe it or not. We ran it on antiwar.com the other day as well. How the FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm great, and thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Oh, really happy you're here. I like this article. It starts out with a mention of a phone call from our friend Jonathan Landay, one of the greatest American newspaper reporters. What's that about?
No, you know, when you work in a congressional office, as I did, you know, in some ways every day is the same, right? And then there are these things that come up that completely change what you're going to be doing for the next day, the next week, and in my case, for the next 2.5 months. And just as I said in the piece, you know, John calls me literally as I'm getting ready to go out the door, and he said, you know, one of your congressman's constituents is being held in an Ethiopian Intelligence Service prison, and I think you're, and this is where I had to kind of clean it up, I think your bleeping former employer is neck deep in this. And I went on, you know, to talk with him a little bit about, you know, what he had discovered, and he wound up running his first piece that night, which talked about this particular young man at the time, Amir Muhammad Mishal of Tinton Falls, New Jersey. And at that point, Monmouth County, in which Tinton Falls is located, was still in Congressman Holt's district. And so, you know, here we have the reporter calling us and telling us that, you know, one of our constituents is being held in a foreign intelligence prison slash jail. And our government, the executive branch, appears to at least have some knowledge of it. So that put me on the path of basically having to try to, you know, reconstruct, you know, how did he get to that part of the world? What was, you know, why was he there to begin with? And why was he being held by a foreign government? And over the course of that next 72 hours or so, I learned that he had gone to Egypt in late 2005 or early 2006 to visit some relatives. He's from an Egyptian-American family. And that, you know, they went back to see their family fairly regularly. And so he had gone there, but then he had decided, for reasons I still don't completely understand, to take a detour and a side trip over to Somalia to ostensibly offer humanitarian assistance to what was then known as the Islamic Courts Union, which was kind of the Islamist organization that was fighting, at that point, the U.S.-backed government. And in the course of all of that, you know, the U.S. government worked with the Ethiopian government and what was left of the Somali government to put together an offensive to drive the Islamic Court Union forces out of the country, at least to the extent they could. And Mishal was among the refugees who ultimately got pushed over into Kenya. And when he crossed the border, he was, of course, detained by Kenyan authorities. And interestingly, the FBI got access to him several days, actually, before the State Department personnel did. So they started interrogating him, and as we began to kind of piece this together, it became clear that they felt that he'd gone to basically join the jihad over there. They accused him of being at al-Qaeda training camps and things of that nature. And when the State Department got to him, you know, he, of course, denied everything and you know, demanded to be deported back to the United States. And before that could happen, Kenyan authorities, and this is the part we still don't, like, have a handle on, Kenyan authorities, either on their own or at the behest of an element of the United States government, deported this guy first back to Somalia, and then he wound up getting transferred over to Ethiopia. And what I found really outrageous about it, beyond the fact that this whole rendition took place, is that they sent him to Ethiopia. He'd never even been in Ethiopia. And even the FBI never asserted that he had been in Ethiopia. So the whole thing was super sketchy. Lande wound up doing some additional stories kind of on this overall theory that he had, which I think is probably accurate, that there were a series of these kinds of operations that were being conducted in the Horn of Africa, basically with the U.S. government working with friendly local governments to detain and basically interrogate individuals they felt were trying to join the Islamic Courts Union, which later turned into al-Shabaab, or trying to join, you know, some other Islamist or Salafist-type terrorist organization. And it's an entire chapter, essentially, of this war on terror that's never really been fully investigated. But long story short, it took me and Congressman Holt about 2.5 months to finally put enough pressure on the executive branch, you know, to get this kid out of there. And by early February, I think the FBI pretty much arrived at the conclusion that the kid was telling the truth, that he had not actually been to any kind of al-Qaeda camp, and so on and so forth. So this whole business of him being detained in Ethiopia and still being interrogated repeatedly by the FBI has never been satisfactorily explained. So in 2009, he contacted the ACLU, and at the time, Jonathan Haifetz, a very prominent civil rights and civil liberties attorney who was working for the ACLU at the time and is now at Seton Hall Law School, agreed to take the case, and he's been representing him ever since, and they've been trying to basically work this case through the courts. And their claim is based on a 1971 court case called Bivens versus the United States. And in that particular case, federal agents, without a warrant, raided Webster Bivens' residence and conducted searches and all the rest of that. And in the end, he was never charged with anything, so Bivens wound up seeking monetary damages, essentially. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he won. And so it set this particular precedent. And what the government has been arguing in Mishal's case is that, hey, this took place on foreign soil. This involves matters of national security. The court really, you know, shouldn't be involved in this. And so far, the case has actually kind of paralleled the original Bivens case in that the district court and then the appellate court agreed with the government, but this ultimately got appealed to the Supreme Court, and that's how Bivens won. And so where we are now is that Mishal and his attorney, Jonathan Haifetz, have to basically make a decision. You know, do they want to go ahead and make that appeal to the full appellate court? And then, you know, if they wind up losing there, also appeal to the Supreme Court. And the difference, of course, today is that the composition of the Supreme Court is very different than what it was in 1971. And it's not at all clear to me, and I think to a lot of legal scholars who know a lot more about the court than I do, that the Supreme Court would necessarily even take up this case should Mishal lose at the full appellate level. So that's kind of the thumbnail of the case.
All right. Well, so there's a lot to go back over there, but we're kind of at a break, so I'll try to ask you a shorter kind of a question. Do you have any idea why it is that this was the FBI and not the CIA that was running all this? Or I don't mean to acquit the CIA. If they're up to their eyeballs in it, too, that's fine. Let me know. But why was this an FBI job at all?
I think that what they've tried to do, and certainly what they did a lot during the Bush administration, was use the FBI essentially as a means, and this is particularly true of Americans, citizens, a means of trying to shake down individuals and find out if they had an involvement. So there was still, even under the Bush administration, a fairly strong kind of law enforcement focus in terms of trying to identify individuals, you know, who either they were certain were involved in terrorism or who they thought might be involved in terrorism, and try to get at them that way. But you had a parallel track, there's no question about it. I mean, this is all during the time that the CIA Black Site program was running, Guantanamo, of course, going full steam. So you had a whole series of different tracks here.
We do know that the special forces and the CIA helped organize and really even run and participated in the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia in Christmas 2006. And that was reported from the very beginning by, I guess, the Post and the Times and officialdom.
Yeah, exactly. So there are just a huge number of unanswered questions from this whole episode. And that's why, you know, just as a practical matter, I think it's really critical that the case go forward.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to see if we can get back to a few of those questions here on the other side of this break with Patrick Eddington from the Cato Institute. He wrote this piece at the New York Times, how the FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show and all that. Talking with Patrick Eddington from Cato. He wrote this thing in the New York Times, how the FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk. He was working for a Democratic congressman named Holt back in 07 when our friend Jonathan Landay, the journalist formerly with McClatchy, I guess now moving over to Reuters, let him know that the government had renditioned a constituent of the congressman. And so he's been on the case ever since then, and there's a big lawsuit and all kinds of things, and very important, America's role in Somalia, of course, as you longtime listeners know. So let's see. There's lots of things I want to ask you. I guess, first of all, do you know, Patrick, how many different people were renditioned with or without the cooperation of the FBI or CIA? I don't know if you can prove that level of this or that, but do you know how many Americans got caught up in this thing by the Kenyan and Ethiopian governments?
You know, at this point, I don't think that we do have, you know, a good solid handle on that. I wound up working this, you know, relatively narrowly from the perspective of just trying to get somebody who lived in our district, you know, out of that prison. But I do know that there were reports of other folks that got swept up in that, as well as other foreign nationals, including folks from, you know, European states, you know, NATO members and things of that nature. But there's never really been a comprehensive examination by Congress or anyone else that I know of.
How about a ballpark? You have any idea? Dozens or hundreds?
No, I really don't. And I think that what we know at this point is Mishal for sure. How many others, you know, may have been swept up in this kind of thing? It's just not clear to me. I don't think that we ever really had a good accounting or a good sense. You know,
maybe none.
Exactly.
Maybe he was the only American. Is that what you're saying?
It's possible. I think one of the things that we've learned, though, not just from this particular period in our history, but from previous periods in our history, is that we almost never have the full facts at the time that the events take place, and that oftentimes many years can really pass before we get a true sense of exactly how much was actually going on. Mishal is the only confirmed case that I personally know of. But what concerns me is that the other kinds of activities that the FBI may well have been engaged in, and some of the other activities that they may have asked other governments to engage in, essentially on behalf of the United States government. And that doesn't just apply to the FBI. Of course, it applies to other agencies of our government that have been engaged in the so-called war on terror. So, for example, we don't know whether or not the Bureau or other agencies like the CIA asked the Ethiopian Intelligence Service or other intelligence services in the region, you know, to kind of routinely monitor the communications of Americans who were staying in their country, for example. We just don't have a handle on that. And one of the things that we need to have is for Congress to actually, you know, take a deep interest in looking at this. And that hasn't been the case so far. We just haven't seen that kind of interest. And
when you say in the piece that you believe, I think is the way you put it, you're under the impression, or some kind of word like that, that it was the FBI had asked the Kenyans to give them to the Ethiopians. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think part of the evidence for that is how easily and how quickly the FBI got access to Mishal wherever he was. Mm-hmm. The State Department always seemed to be days behind even finding out that Mashal was in a given country or had even been moved to another country. But because the House Foreign Affairs Committee elected not to investigate this case, the House Appropriations Committee, you know, elected not to look at this, the House Judiciary Committee, and Mr. Holt asked. I mean, he didn't just write letters. I mean, he would actually catch members on the floor and ask them, hey, you know, can you help me out here? And he never got anything like, you know, the kind of cooperation that he needed in order to be able to get to ground truth on exactly what was happening here. I mean, the best we were able to do is kind of keep up public pressure and pressure on the agencies to ultimately get the kid out of there. And he spoke to our ambassador to Ethiopia at least on a weekly basis, sometimes on a daily basis, you know, trying to get updates about what they were going to do to get the kid out of there. Mm-hmm. And the Ethiopians, you know, put up a bunch of bogus charges against him, all of which, you know, ultimately went away. But the whole thing was just so sketchy because he had never been in Ethiopia. You know, so how did the Ethiopians even really legitimately have interest, any kind of legitimate claim on him? They didn't. And that's why I'm convinced to this day that it was the FBI, possibly, you know, in coordination with other federal agencies, that were basically asking the Ethiopian government to keep him there for as long as possible in order to continue the interrogations.
Mm-hmm. And now you quote, and we're going to get to the real point of the quote here, but you quote this judge, the dissenting judge, in your piece in the New York Times here, referring to these injuries that this person had suffered. And we'll get back to the court case, the legality there. But can you tell us more about these injuries? Is she talking about just the way he was transported, or was he tortured? Was he beaten?
So Mashal has claimed, and this is what's contained in the court filings in the case, that he was, in fact, physically abused by the FBI and that he was repeatedly threatened with death and disappearance by these agents. He lost, you know, something like 80 pounds during the course of his captivity, and there were at least 30-some-odd interrogation sessions that took place. So, I mean, they were
lost
really...
Lost 80 pounds, so that could have killed him unless, you know, he really
yeah.
needed to lose 80
yeah.
pounds.
Yeah, right. So this is what happened to him, you know, as he has alleged, and certainly his physical condition when he got back from everything that I was told was pretty much exactly as been described in the court filing. So... those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. And just,
and
know,
I have a feeling
whole,
you're going to tell me this is a guy that was not 100 pounds overweight before.
No, he definitely was not. And I think, you know, the biggest injury of all, you know, besides all this coercion and threats of disappearance and all the rest of that, which is the kind of behavior that you expect from, let's say, a Soviet Union or North Korea or an Iran or whatever, you know, like totalitarian or authoritarian states engage in this kind of practice. The injury here is the complete denial of the guy's rights. And the fact that they're able to get away with this right now, right, should be of concern to every person in this country. Mm-hmm. Because if they can get away with it here in this particular circumstance, then it opens the floodgates for them to be able to do it, you know, to just about anybody down the line. If you happen to get caught overseas and they happen to decide that for whatever reason, legitimate or otherwise, that you have some kind of connection to terrorism, they can just go to a host government and say, hey, can you hold this individual for us so we can come by and interrogate them, you know, for as long as we want.
And as we've seen, some kind of connection to terrorism can mean it was imagined by a cop one time or anything, right? They don't need anything.
Yeah, I mean, and that is so true, because if you think about the case of Brandon Mayfield, the Oregon lawyer, Portland, Oregon lawyer, who was falsely implicated in Madrid bombing, the FBI had a botched fingerprint analysis that they used to get FISA warrants to basically search his home, to put taps on all of his devices, all the rest of that, and they turned his world upside down, and at the end of the day, he had no connection to the case at all. But, you know, and this is exactly how these kinds of things happen. And that's why if you don't have the strong, really probing oversight of these federal law enforcement agencies, they run amok. And I can say the same thing about Customs and Border Protection. I could say it about DEA or ATF.
Well, in fact, in the Mayfield case, I'm pretty certain the way I remember it, the Spanish had told them that they were wrong about the fingerprint.
Yeah,
and
right.
they persisted anyway.
Yeah,
and it wasn't until the Spanish went public with it that they finally backed down. I interviewed him back then, but it's been a decade ago. But
yeah, but I mean, it's just kind of a classic example. And, you know, I mean, here you have a Muslim American, an Arab American, And a lot of folks in this country are not necessarily going to be sympathetic, you know, in that circumstance. But that doesn't matter, right? I mean,
right.
the law doesn't care, you know, whether you're a sympathetic figure or an unsympathetic figure. The entire idea of equal justice under the law is just that. I mean, everybody is supposed to be treated the same.
Yeah, and a U.S. person is any American citizen anywhere in the world. And just as well as it's any person, whether they're a citizen or not, inside U.S. borders. But you don't stop being a U.S. person just because you're in Somalia.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's the point that Hafetz has been making. And that was kind of the central tenet of, you know, of Bivens. And what the government here is trying to do in their argument is decouple Mishal's rights from where he happens to be located. And that's a huge reason why this case is so important. And if the government prevails, it really is going to kind of begin a new dark age in that respect.
Yeah. Well, and here, right before I let you go, let me get to this great quote of the judge here, because I think it's important the way this is the dissenting judge, unfortunately. But the way she puts it, there's real authority behind this, I think. Had Meshel suffered these injuries in the United States, there is no dispute that he could have sought redress under Bivens. And if his tormentors had been foreign officials, he could have sought a remedy under the Torture Victim Protection Act. Yet the majority has decided, they're basically carving out, end quote here, they're basically carving out a new immunity that says, as long as you mix it up and you have the FBI involved, and it's outside the country, then they can get away with it.
That's right. That's where this is heading, unless...
And there's no real court precedent for that. They're basically making this up brand new because they want to go along with the prosecution saying national security, national security.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Amazing. Because, you know, the republic, such as it is, has been around for 230-something years here. Or, well, 215-something. Oh, yeah. Since the Constitution was ratified. So it seems like they would have got around to having laws like this settled about how this works before. It's funny they would have to come up with these kind of interpretations in 2015 for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Hmm.
Hey, listen, thank you very much for coming on the show, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all. That is Patrick Eddington. He's at the Cato Institute, and he wrote this in the New York Times, how the FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.